Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, Katia Kosbeck will look behind the glistening image of Alexei Navalny, the Russian politician beloved of Moscow and Western elites. And Marianella D'Aprile will talk about the shortcomings of mutual aid. I feel like I should say something about the GameStop circus, but I've been talking and writing about it on so many outlets that I'm afraid I'm repeating myself. If you want my views at some length, check out my article on the topic on the Jacobin Magazine website or my appearance on The Daily Show, an extremely satisfying brush with fame, I have to admit, last week. I'll say just two things. One, you can't overturn the financial system by buying stocks. The Redditors may have wounded one hedge fund, but they actually made several others richer, to the tune of over $1 billion. And two, the incident highlights what a ludicrous institution the stock market is, of little importance to the broad economy or the vast majority of the public that owns few or no stocks. As John Maynard Keynes said, when the capital development of a country becomes the byproduct of the activities of a casino, the job is likely to be ill done. Enough of me. Alexei Navalny is a Russian opposition figure, lawyer, politician, and anti-corruption activist. He's been in the Russian scene for years, but achieved worldwide notice last August when he was poisoned, presumably by the Russian security services. The poison, Novichok, was developed during the Soviet era and is supposedly massively toxic. After treatment in Germany, Navalny survived. Russian President Vladimir Putin denied responsibility for the incident, joking in his inimitable style that had it been the security services, they would have finished the job. Now one of Putin's courts has sent Navalny off to prison, which is certainly no way to treat your political enemy. But that doesn't make him a hero. Navalny has long been the darling of Western media and governments. On January 30th, the New York Times ran a story asserting that he was uniting disparate strands of opposition to Putin, socialists, monarchists, libertarians, behind him. This seems to overstate the case, but Western elites have a long tradition, going back to the late Soviet days, of celebrating opposition figures with little actual support in Russia, outside a small circle of Moscow liberals. On closer inspection, Navalny's image doesn't really survive the myth-making. He has a lot of unsavory beliefs and allies, ones that his fans, at the times, prefer to overlook. The article I mentioned acknowledges in six words that his nationalist politics turned off many liberals, without going into details about what those were all about. It also conceded that his brusque style alienated women, without noticing that that style included brandishing a gun in his videos, symbolically aimed at ethnic minorities. Here with more about Navalny is Katia Kosbeck. Kosbeck is a Russian-born, New York-based writer, translator, and editor of the website Supermodu, which, in its own words, is a daily online magazine that explores independent film, art, music, and books from around the world. In the middle of the interview, Kosbeck mentions the LDPR, the Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, which, as the cliché runs, is neither liberal nor democratic. It's an authoritarian nationalist party opposed to both communism and neoliberalism that longs to restore Russian imperial greatness. Although it sometimes uses anti-government rhetoric, it generally supports Putin, and there's some speculation that it gets funding from the Kremlin. Okay, here's Katia Kosbeck. Western liberals and Western media are in love with Alexei Navalny. There's an article in the Times the other day acknowledging that maybe he has some problems, but people across the political spectrum now are uniting behind him as some kind of alternative to the evil Putin. Who is this guy? Where did he come from? What does he stand for? Who is his base, if any?
Basically, Alexei Navalny is someone who has a 15-year political career in Russia. And throughout his career, he has been changing quite a bit, although it seems that, at least according to a very recent interview with the German website Die Spiegel, he has said that his views seem to remain the same as when he started out. So he initially started out in mid-2000s, and he was a part of this liberal, Western-oriented, free market-oriented party, Yabloko. However, soon there became a conflict between that and his involvement in nationalism, for which he was kicked out of Yabloko, and he actually started attending nationalist rallies, the so-called Russian marches.
When you say nationalist, and this isn't just rah-rah Russia, it's nastier than that, right?
Yeah, it's basically like his own brand of nationalism was identified by resisting migration from ex-Soviet republics. He recorded a bunch of videos a little bit later after that when he already founded his own movement that was called Narod, People, where he compared migrants to cockroaches, and he also actually called himself an avowed nationalist and invited others to join him, and he also showed, like, those videos are interesting because he doesn't specifically say, like, let's kill people from this region and that region, or just, like, let's bash migrants. But the visuals and everything, like, they quite an image. And
yeah, there's one with a gun, right?
Yeah, there is also the one where he talks about cockroaches. He says that if you can't deal with cockroaches and flies using your shoe or swatter, that you should just resort to using a gun. And he has been a staunch gun rights supporter. I think this has not wavered throughout his career, and he's not been trying to back away from it. Yeah, so, and he also, like, the nationalist rallies that he participated in, he kept on participating in them until mid 2010s, because and those are rallies where all kinds of nationalist parties, movements, etc. in Russia get together. So they're like from like left nationalists, right nationalists, everything in between, and that's where like some people are starting to like do the Nazi salute and stuff like that. So and he's gotten a lot of flack for that, and he has stopped going there at one point. However, once again, in that interview that I've mentioned, and also in another interview with The Guardian in 2018, when asked about those videos that he made, he said that he doesn't regret anything. He was happy to be able to work as kind of a link between nationalists and liberals, and that he thinks that comparing migrants to cockroaches is something that he could do as an artistic license. Nationalism basically didn't really get him that far either, although he managed to accomplish some stuff, like he protested the building of a mosque in one of the neighborhoods in Russia. I think actually the one where he lives, or the one near there, which is something that he, as I understand, picked up when he was spent some time in the U.S. In the U.S., he attended this program that's called the World Fellowship at Yale, and his chief of staff and close ally, Leonid Volkov, he also attended that program, as did, for instance, some people who were instrumental in the Ukrainian Maidan. And
a setback a moment. Does he have a background as an intellectual or an academic? I mean, what's his prehistory before?
No, yeah, that's actually a good question. Before he went into politics, he's a lawyer by education, and he also, I think he worked in some kind of trading, stock trading or something like that for a while. I don't think he was successful. And he also has a history of working as a lawyer for some companies throughout his years that also coincided with his political activity, which basically he worked for a lumber company and for a company that deals with cosmetics. And those two companies are at the center of the two criminal cases where he was charged for fraud, which he calls frame-ups. The European Court for the Human Rights considers them incorrect and that they should be dismissed, but like we can't know for sure, I don't think. But basically, that's also why when he returned from Germany recently after his poisoning, he was immediately detained, because the fact that he left for Germany to get treatment was in violation of his parole because of his suspended sentences. I think only one of them remains right now. So yeah, so that's his background. The turning point came when he was accepted to this Yale program. He went there, and afterwards he really started gaining momentum in Russia, although I'd say rather in Moscow. And he also had written, for instance, on his Twitter about how when he was in that Yale program, he participated in his first debates in English, and was very excited about it. And the debates were centered around the building of the mosque in, I think, on Ground Zero.
Oh, he's involved in that. That's appalling.
Well, I don't think he, like, actually had to do anything. I think it's just that during his course or whatever this fellowship thing at Yale intended, they were just discussing this. So I don't know if...
Okay, he's not cheering Pam Geller on, though.
Yeah, no. I didn't think it, like, was in any way meaningful. But basically, he did repeat the same thing with the mosque in Russia, and successfully. There has been a much concerted effort to whitewash his views in the past times, because he's a very... a staunch populist, and basically tries to shift his policies wherever seems more advantageous.
Is he just an opportunist, or does he have some kind of deep-seated philosophy of politics?
I don't think so. And I don't think that he's a downright grifter as well. I think he does really believe that, but I think that mostly it's kind of, he is a narcissist to some extent, although that's, of course, an emotional evaluation. But I do think that he does see himself as a leader. He and everything that he does is always centered around his persona. And that's why it's also you have things like those videos, for instance, where he was there right in front of the camera, not just some voiceover linked to his party, but basically him, because he always wants to be at the front of whatever he's doing. And he still, for instance, has this one of those nationalist videos on his personal YouTube account, which is verified. But as nationalism was not going that well, he decided to get more into bed with the neoliberal politics. And since that happened, I guess, with the protests, which happened in Russia in approximately 10 years ago after the Duma elections that were deemed fraudulent. Those protests, they had a lot of leaders, like there was a whole committee of leaders, but Navalny was one of the most prominent people. And in the aftermath of those protests, he also ran for Moscow mayor against the incumbent Sergei Sobyanin, and he lost. But he did if Sergei Sobyanin managed to get 51%, if he got 50, then they would have another round of the election. This is also when I visited his campaign headquarters when he was running for mayor, and came in firsthand with how the instruction to volunteers was to deflect any questions about nationalism. And also, like, there was this weird rant from a person who was teaching the volunteers to canvass about how we need more Slavic faces in the streets of Russia, and they have too many migrants and things like that. So
now, that kind of thing, you could imagine that appeals to a populist mass base, but then the pro-market stuff appeals to an elite base. How does he manage to balance those competing forces?
I think he doesn't really do it that well, because basically I've been writing a lot about him recently, and it seems like that he doesn't really satisfy any kind of group of people, because the nationalists find that he's not Nazi enough, and basically whenever his dealings are mentioned, or the fact that he didn't really denounce them, they're like, oh no, that's weak sauce. He's not really enough of a nationalist. Then liberals, for liberals, he isn't liberal enough. Pro-market people, I think he does have quite a few people who are very much into all those privatizations, which are part of his platform. For instance, oligarch Khodorkovsky, who was put in prison by Putin for the murder of the mayor of the company town where he's oil company was Yukos. And he, for instance, he lives abroad now, but he is giving a lot of money to Navalny, and as well as support, informational support with his media. And there are a lot of people in his circle who are former Putin's government members or Yeltsin's government members who are connected to different facets of Russian economy. And for instance, Nemtsov, Boris Nemtsov, who was murdered and was another opposition leader. He used to be one of the people who instrumental to the economic reforms in the 90s that had successfully plunged a whole lot of people in Russia into an economic depression and poverty.
I'm speaking with Katia Kozbek. I would think that having those kinds of associations would make one very unpopular.
Yeah, absolutely. And because his aim is towards small business owners, for instance, or also he offers in his policy a lot of leeways for people who want to privatize stuff. He is popular among them, although, of course, they are a very small number of people, and we don't count those ones who are already loyal to the existing regime. But among the regular people, he is not popular at all. He scores at 2% approval rates, where Putin has a 40, and Navalny is third with his 2, but the 4% belong to a pro-government nationalist party, LDPR's leader Zhirinovsky. But also, if you take also the popularity of, for instance, the Communist Party and LDPR, they also have much bigger popularity than him. And even after the poisoning, which made him way more noticeable, even to people who are not into, say, oppositional media or into politics in general, he became people became more aware, but the level of trust in him, it did rise, but at the same time, the level of distrust rose as well. So it's kind of like he's getting more awareness, but it's not something that can be garnered for success. So I think it's very far removed from what's actually happening on the ground in Russia when he is being called the leader of the protest movement, the leader of the opposition, or when the protests that are happening right now in Russia are called protests for Navalny, because first of all, not all people who are protesting there are actually doing this because of him. And it's also kind of hard to know how many aren't, because this kind of like white washes over such nuance. But at the same time, there are other things that are more important and way more applicable to a larger set of people in Russia than just the support for Navalny that would make them protest instead.
Yeah. Now, what about the what's Putin's political status now? He's not as popular as he once was, but how strong is the feeling against him?
What is correct to say is that that there's not an alternative. So basically, not everyone is happy with him, and they're increasingly less happy. The biggest thing that Putin has to his advantage is the fact that life for the people has improved since the 90s, and they are currently feeling way more secure, even though, of course, it's not much to write home about. But even this small difference is enough, and people are saying that it's actually not that bad having a business. There's less racket than there used to be, like in the 90s when everything was mafia infested. And even though his corruption is widespread and especially linked to people who are close to him or his dealings, it somehow becomes a sort of this weird version of, I guess, a trickle-down economics in this sense that the people at the top are very happy, so the rest of the people can do so. So while it's definitely not preferable, and I'm sure that given a viable alternative, the majority of the Russian people would denounce that, I think that basically what Navalny has to offer, even though he does advocate for, he has recently started advocating, especially noticing how popular Bernie Sanders is. He started advocating for better wages and better pensions still, because it's unclear what's going to happen with him, and because he also is so bent on free markets and all privatizations that people just don't see this as a viable alternative. However, what Putin also has done recently were, for instance, the changes in the constitution, which were voted for in a referendum, but still not exactly democratically. For instance, he's going to be able to extend his term limits, and he's going to be able to stay in power. And then there are also some particular freedoms that are infringed upon, for instance, queer rights, things like that. Although, of course, that's not something that's a universal concern. But the universal concern is that Putin also has implemented a sprawling pension reform, which has started last year. Not last year, in 2019. He has, it has basically increased the retirement age by 5 years for most people, and except for, like, for instance, like indigenous people who are exempt of that. But right now for men, it's a couple years before the age, the medium death age in Russia. So basically, while women, I think, are going to live like for 20 years after retirement, men are now supposed to retire and die soon afterwards. So that's something that has been talked about a lot and angering a lot of people. However, there have not been overwhelming protests against that, and I'm not exactly sure why. I think that there's just not enough political and class struggle has been garnered in that sense. But I think that despite that, there has been quite a lot of organizing based on that. And it has propelled, for instance, the power of unions. And they have been rising all across the country in the past few years, especially. And so that's very noticeable.
Now, I'm guessing that given the coverage that we see in the Western media, Washington and other Western capitals would like to see Navalny replace Putin. Is he some sort of favored candidate of the Western imperial class?
Yeah, I think it's just basically those oligarchs and who are not included in the current system, or like, for instance, like Khodorkovsky or like some others, because I think, for instance, like Mikhail Friedman, one of the other large bankers who were in the so-called seven bankers period during Yeltsin's time, who were essentially like running things. He has supported Navalny. The bet on Navalny is a way to, and that's something that a lot of people are saying, even if they don't want to support this in terms of like the neoliberal aspects of it, that a bet on Navalny is just to ensure that there is a change of regime, because that and corruption seem to be the main two preoccupying things with the current situation among Navalny supporters, although in general they also are big concerns for anyone from the whole side of the from any side of the spectrum, because they are probably two of the biggest issues tied in together, because corruption doesn't allow the country to develop as it could have, and also is really detrimental to the regions, especially because even though you have free medicine, free education, everything in terms of social services is very limited because money gets stolen on the way there to the region. Those who see themselves making it in the new government are very excited about this, but that obviously doesn't extend to the general population, because it's probably going to be the same, or unfortunately, probably even worse, which is something that we have, for instance, seen in Ukraine, where after the Maidan, the economic situation plummeted and has been in a recession for a while now.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of these forces that you're talking about are the ones that brought Russia to ruin 20 years ago, and they're going to make it come back.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that's that people are very, very afraid of, because the 90s were just such a dark times with so many losing their jobs because of privatizations and factories and the economic reforms. And so many were just downright murdered or like lost their relatives or some possessions because the mafia was rampant. And just like the relative peace that exists right now, even though, of course, you cannot exactly call Putin super peaceful in terms that he does persecute everyone who is against his politics, and like be it Navalny himself or communists or people in between. So there's definitely this very big fear, especially when you have figures from the 90s that were very prominently appearing and making a claim in this expected Russia under Navalny.
That was Katya Kozbek, a Russian-born writer and translator now based in New York, and editor of the online magazine Supamodu, SUPAMODU.com, which looks at culture around the world. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was a version of the Russian national anthem performed with electric guitar in the spirit of Jimi Hendrix's rendition of the Star Spangled Banner by Sean Atwood DeVries. I don't know anything else about this version other than I found it on the internet about 5 or 7 years ago, and now I can't find a trace of it. The Russian national anthem uses the same tune, though with different words, as the old Soviet anthem, which says something about historical ghosts. That pedigree annoyed Russian anti-communists. Boris Yeltsin, who drove the country to ruin with the assistance of the Clinton administration, complained that Putin should not have blindly followed the will of the people in selecting the anthem. And Yabloko, the liberal party that Navalny was associated with for a while, complained that it deepened the schisms in Russian society, which is funny coming from a party that has very little popular support. Next, mutual aid, a term that has come up during the pandemic as state aid has so often been missing in action. Of course, humans have always helped each other out in times of crisis, but as a political concept, mutual aid has deep roots in anarchist thought. It is notably the title of a collection of essays by the anarchist philosopher Peter Kropotkin. The idea is that people should take care of each other in non-hierarchical voluntary fashion. It's intended not only to alleviate suffering, but also to prefigure a post-capitalist society, one characterized by egalitarianism, free association, and solidarity, without the heavy coercive hand of the state or large-scale bureaucracy. While mutual aid sits comfortably in the anarchist tradition, its relationship with socialist and social democratic politics is more problematic. Socialists and social democrats are far friendlier to the idea of organization on a scale larger than the face-to-face scale of mutual aid. Marianella De Aprile, a member of the National Political Committee of the Democratic Socialists of America, has an article criticizing the concept in the February issue of In These Times. Here she is with more. Marianella De Aprile. I recall back at the time of Hurricane Sandy in New York City, the response of the government was really, really poor. People were desperate. Homeless, hungry, all kinds of, you know, standard human miseries after a natural disaster. And there was a big move shortly after Occupy Wall Street, and they're all those networks are very much intact and easily re-energized. There's a lot of mutual aid going on. And At the time, I was not quite sure of how to think about it, whether it was good in itself, you know, the pointing to a better future, or it was just doing the best in a situation where the state's response was so desperately inadequate. What are your thoughts on this? Mutual aid has a long history in anarchist politics, but what are your thoughts on how it should figure in socialist politics?
Yeah, there are going to be times when we look around and we see that nothing is being done, and that, you know, unless we take things, matters into our own hands, nothing is going to be done. And that was probably the case then. Certainly, I think that's been the case over the last year of the pandemic. I think people are suffering in really, really deep ways. And it makes total sense to me that people who are socialists, who are committed to the betterment of our collective lives, would also be invested in helping, you know, help directly helping other people around them. And I think that there are going to be times when we feel called to do that. I think, though, that our project can't be limited to just that. And I think any time that we do engage in, you know, projects of direct service, we have to be thinking about how can we use them to actually build long-lasting organization and power for the working class. And I think that's a very, very hard question to answer. And I think it, you know, probably or almost definitely will vary from context to context, city to city. But, you know, I often think about how I don't want to end up in a situation where the work that we're doing is perceived as charity, or that people feel that they owe something to the people that are helping them, like, you know, sort of like joining the organization is a kind of requirement to receiving whatever it is that you might be getting, a coat, a hot meal, or whatever. I think we want to avoid those kinds of situations. I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that those are sort of hard to avoid because I think the charity model is so prevalent in a lot of like American sort of activism, or has been for a long time. So there are certainly going to be moments where we feel called to participate in direct service, and we should not shy from that. At the same time, I think that we always need to be doing that in the service of building working class power and building our movement. And I mean, I can give examples of that too.
It fits nicely into anarchist philosophy. It's non-state, you know, it's very localized, it's very non-coercive. It doesn't fit quite so easily in socialist politics, but, you know, what does socialist politics tell us about living our daily lives? I mean, you know, we don't want to do charity, we don't want to make aid contingent upon joining an organization, but, you know, how should we think more clearly about these kinds of relationships?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm a socialist because I believe that the power to change things in the world comes when working class people get together and they exercise, I think, the most powerful tool that they have, which is withholding their labor in order to extract concessions and win the things that they deserve. Right now, that sounds probably quite abstract to a lot of people, just because we look at the numbers, right? Like 10% of the workforce in this country is unionized. And there's not a lot of experience with like democratic decision making and wielding of collective power at all. And so our individual or personal lives have in many, many ways become the primary site of everything, but especially of politics. There's a kind of general habit. I don't think so much on the left, but certainly, you know, among liberals, that's sort of where you exercise your politics, which is really sort of like your own personal opinions, is like in your personal life. And so I think following from that logic, it can be really easy to say, well, you know, I volunteer at a soup kitchen, or I, you know, collect clothes for a drive or something like that. And again, I think that's all fine and well. People feel called to do that. And I think often there's going to be the need for that. I think that we as socialists, if we want to think about helping each other on a kind of individual person-to-person level fulfill our daily needs, we also need to figure out how that feeds into a larger project, again, of building our organization, building working class power. I mean, I think some of the most obvious examples of that are the work that DSA has done around strike support.
Yeah, you discussed that the support for the Oakland teachers. Draw that distinction. It's an interesting one.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you know, when in 2019, in the fall of 2019, CTU here in Chicago, the Chicago Teachers Union went on strike. They were out for, I think, 3 weeks. we, Chicago DSA, organized a program called Bread for Ed. And we put together meals for, a lot of them were for actually students, right, who had depended on going to school to eat, you know, usually at least, you know, at least one, but usually or oftentimes two meals a day. And this is obviously a very, very strong tool that the boss has to say, well, look at these teachers. They're out. They're on strike. And they are denying their students not only education, they're also denying their students meals. And so what we did was say, was take that away. We took away that tool that the mayor had, that CPS had, to make the teachers seem like the villains. We took that away by saying, we are going to fulfill this need for these students. And some teachers, too, I think, definitely, like, were some of the meals, I mean, went to teachers as well. And so that I think, is an example of direct service, absolutely. But it was also in the service of helping the teachers, helping the union retain its power and being able to exercise that or use that tool that I was talking about of withholding their labor to get what they wanted.
Yeah, now I can hear some people, to use that phrase that Bhaskar Sankara revived, but I think it has its origins in Tito's Yugoslavia, the anarcho-liberals saying, well, you seem to care more about humanity in the abstract and your organization than you do about actual people. And you know, they'll wag your fingers at you for being, you know, cold and instrumental about your willingness to aid people in distress. So how would you respond to that?
I became a socialist because I have nothing but absolute love for people. And I think that the only way that we're going to get the world that we deserve, where everyone gets to thrive, where all people get to thrive, is through class struggle. I think that's the only way that change actually happens. I think that has been proven by history, and we don't even have to look, you know, we don't even have to look that far to see that borne out in history. To use like the most popular example, look at, you know, what Sarah Nelson, the flight attendants, were able to achieve in ending the government shutdown just a few years ago. And I think that building the power to do that and being, I will cop. Sometimes we do have to be cold and calculating in order to build strategies that will work in order to give us that world where we all get to like fully experience our warm and not calculating humanity. Yes, absolutely. And I think that there is also...
Time is limited after all, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes, that's right. And I think that our time is limited. There are only, you know, something I think about often is that there are only so many socialists in the world. I mean, I would like to make a lot more of them, obviously. And that's a huge part of what I've committed my life to doing, is making more socialists and organizing them. And we have a very specific contribution to make. And so I think when it comes down to thinking about what is it that socialists specifically should spend their time on, I think that, you know, I think socialists are the only people who are, or some of the only people who are going to dedicate time and energy to this project of building working class organization through unions, through organizations like DSA, and building working class power, and then pointing it in the direction of capital to extract concessions. And I think that is the role of socialists, and that is the role of socialist movements. And I think that it's very different. The tasks that we do as political actors and political people are different than what we do in our personal lives. Like, for example, you know, okay, I live in Chicago, and I have spent the last, we just had this blizzard come through over the weekend, and it snowed for like 72 hours straight. And I've spent, you know, every day every time I go outside, I'm, you know, helping someone dig out their car, or like pushing someone over like a snowbank or something, or, you know, or people are helping me like get my, you know, I'm walking my dog, like get my dog over a snowbank because the snow is piled really, really high. My belief that we have to be strategic and absolutely cold and calculating does not interfere with my ability to be warm and kind to other people. And, you know, I have to say, our enemy, the capitalist class, is cold and calculating, and they know exactly the tools that they have in their tool belt, and they're ruthless, and they're not afraid to use them against us, and we should not be afraid to use them against them.
Well, also among the tools in that capitalist tool belt are philanthropy, charity. I mean, that's a very important part of their power.
Absolutely. And I think that that's, I think frequently about how charity and philanthropy are used both to sort of placate people politically, I think, in two ways. One, you know, if you're being asked to be charitable or to give, you know, that can be your contribution. But then if you have some needs that are being fulfilled by philanthropy or by charity, then you have this sort of like short-term solution that blinds you or can blind you to figuring out how to win a more long-term solution to the needs that you face. And I think as socialists, we have to be constantly fighting against that, the effect, both of those effects of the kind of philanthropy and charity at the hands of capitalists.
I'm speaking with Marianella De Aprile. I know some years ago, there was a controversy within DSA. I think it's receded some, but the brake light clinics. The idea was to fix brake lights for people, mostly poor black people, to help them avoid getting stopped by the cops and then run into very serious trouble with the police. A lot of people thought that would be a way to win friends and do a good deed at the same time. There was some pointing to the model of the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, which I think had those dual goals as well. Where did you stand on that controversy?
I'm trying to remember exactly when that was and if I had moved to Chicago yet. I can't remember.
I think it was around 2016.
Yeah, I think it was 2016. I think it was before I had moved to Chicago. I'm just saying this to jog my own memory. But where I stood was that was not the place that we should be spending our time. I felt like it was a charity project. You know, I think there are some differences between the free breakfast program that the Black Panthers were leading. In particular, you know, I don't think that what was being put forward with the brake lights at the time. My point is that at the time, I felt like there was a lot of energy around what was then a still kind of incipient campaign for Medicare for All. And energy had been building around Medicare for All. I was living in California at the time, and there was a state bill that we were starting to organize around. And I felt like this was the thing to do if we wanted to build our organization and if we wanted to speak to people who were working class, who were maybe not in the demographics that would have automatically joined DSA, right? So, like, people of color in particular. I felt like that was something that would disproportionately benefit people's lives and people's material conditions, and so we could speak to them about that and bring them in through the organization in that way, bring them into the organization with the message that DSA and the socialist movement more broadly is a place where they could fight for the things that they deserve and the things that they need. And to me, that was much more powerful than what I felt the brake light clinics were doing, which was saying, well, you know, here are your nice, friendly neighborhood socialists who are going to do this nice thing for you. And maybe you'll get a little bit of political education out of it, and maybe you'll hear what DSA is about. But for me, the question has always been, how do we build power by bringing people in to the socialist movement by presenting it as the place where I know, and you know, my comrades know, it's the only place where we can do what we need to do in this world, which is fight for the things that we believe in through getting ourselves organized and moving in large groups of people, sort of in the same direction, both literally and figuratively. And so, at the time, I guess that's where I stood at the time to answer your original question. Is that I thought, you know, DSA was still very much incipient. I think at that time, we didn't even have 10,000 members, and I thought the place to put our energy is...
Oh, you're an early member.
Well, early, quote-unquote. I joined
by recent standards, yeah.
Yeah. I joined in 2016. So I thought we need to be building this organization into a mass organization, and the way we're going to do that is by making by building campaigns around mass demand. And that doesn't mean that those campaigns can't have very localized elements that respond to very local conditions. I think that absolutely I think that's a prerequisite of any good campaign. And even some of those elements might even include direct service, but I think, you know, kind of doing a direct service on its own exclusively, which I think the Bright Lakes clinics are, as I understand them, are an example of that. I think that's just insufficient and not a strategic use of our time.
In this Times piece, you say, in this time of unbearable crisis and human suffering, I'm hard-pressed to find a good reason to tell my comrades that they shouldn't donate to a food pantry or collect outerwear to give to families. But obviously, this conflicts with some of your political thinking. How have you resolved this conflict in your head? Are you still up in the air about it?
No, I'm not. I don't think I'm up in the air at all. I think it relates to what I was saying earlier. Maybe this only makes sense to me and not to other people. But I think that there are actions that we take as political actors and as political organizers and as socialists. And I think all of those are almost exclusively taken with our comrades, decided upon with other people. You know, DSA is an incredibly democratic organization. We have processes for deliberation and decision making that affect the organization, that have results on the organization and the kinds of things that the kind of projects and campaigns that we take on. And I think there's a difference between that and the things that we do in our personal lives. Like, I would never tell my comrade who was like, oh, I'm collecting cans for, you know, a food pantry. I would never be like, oh, that's a really bad idea. Like, if you want to do that as like an individual, I think that's totally fine. And again, I think that relates to what I was saying earlier about, I don't believe that, our individual lives are the side of our politics and politics and political action. I think only happens in collective, deliberative, and democratic spaces.
So any kinds of action should at best be oriented towards some longer-term goal and not just day-to-day relief.
I think so, right? So let's say that same person that person that I just invented who was collecting cans to take to a food pantry comes to a meeting like a DSA meeting and proposes to take on as a chapter project or something. I would want to know, what I would want that person to answer is, how is this building long lasting working class organization, and how is it making more socialists? How is it helping us build DSA? You know, And to tie back to the example I was using earlier, because I think I would ask that question not just of a direct service project. I would ask that question of any campaign or anything that was being proposed to being taken on by DSA. You know, I would ask, how is it building working class power? How is it building DSA? And how is it making more socialists? And again, to tie it back to the example that I used earlier of Bread for Ed, I think that project or that campaign answers those questions pretty well. You know, I think it was, again, building the power of teachers, or helping bolster the power of teachers to stay out on strike when there was obviously something that was going to be used against them in the form of, you know, blaming them for their kids going starving. I think it also helped us build organizational relationships between Chicago DSA and SEIU 73 and the CTU, which was really, really crucial and important. And I think it also helped us have conversations about why people were out fighting and what that meant and what it meant to exercise their power in their union, and how that related to the politics that we were there representing. You know, DSA members, Chicago DSA members were out on the picket line every single day of the strike. And in many ways, you know, I don't know, I guess you could probably think of that as an opening to creating more socialists.
And to take it back finally to the what I opened with, the Hurricane Sandy relief and its relation to Occupy. You've been talking consistently about the importance of organization and building an organization with goals. And a lot of people around Occupy were hostile to both the idea of organization and goals. So this seems to be a really bright line difference between these two approaches to politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. You know, I was not politically active around Occupy, and I was much younger than I am now. I was not politically active around Occupy, but so I can't, you know, speak super directly to the arguments that were being made, but I do think that there is a distinct difference between a kind of an anarchist project and a socialist project. And, you know, without getting too far into questions of like who controls the state, I think fundamentally, I think, yes, absolutely, socialists do have goals. I mean, I think immediately it is extracting material wins from the capitalist class. I think that, and that is a goal, and we have to have that goal, and then we have to have a plan to get there, and we have to have people moving in concert to get there and exercising whatever power they have in order to get there. And in order to get people moving in concert, you need organization. And then, you know, we obviously there's, you know, much longer term goals, and also like subsidiary goals to all of that. But I'm invested in that, in this idea that, you know, we're not going to get anywhere, I don't think, without organization.
That's true. Couldn't agree more. All right. Thanks a lot. That was Marianella D'Aprile, a member of the National Political Committee, the governing body of DSA, and author of a critique of mutual aid in the February issue of In These Times. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I played a couple of bits recently featuring the flutist Claire Chase, which attracted an unusual amount of subsequent email interest. Here's some more of her work. This an excerpt from Terrestre by the Finnish composer Kaija Saraiho. She performs with the International Contemporary Ensemble. Till next week, bye. Thank you.